Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It's Monday, March 24th. Today we hear from the Hawaii Department of Education about how our school lunch program stands to be affected by the cuts ordered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Will the feds be open to having poi, seaweed, and tofu on the menu? We learn more about the triennial art offerings around town. We explore healing art. After a trauma, what can we learn? We take a closer look at the origins of iguanas in the Pacific. Hint, they came from far, far away. And the challenges to find new forever homes for dogs being cared for at Maui's animal shelters. Things were bad before the wildfires. And in a nod to Women's History Month, we Hanahoa segment marking the anniversary of women on military combat ships. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. In the first months of the second Trump administration, there are fears about drastic cuts to federal programs as President Donald Trump makes good on his campaign promise to reduce the size of the federal government. One of the targets is the U.S. Department of Education. But today we hear about how cuts to the U.S. Department of Agriculture will impact the school lunch program. Students from low-income families are eligible for free or reduced meals in our public schools. And there is also a program to buy from local farmers, and those funds are on the chopping block. A team from Hawaii, led by Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke, is in D.C. this week to meet with federal agricultural officials as part of a policy summit. Luke is there to argue Hawaii's case as a unique island state in a centralized department in hopes of reducing the impact. This morning, we talked to Dean Uchida, Deputy Superintendent of Operations for the Hawaii Department of Education. The food service program is just one of the areas he's responsible for. He took over in January and has been working toward the state goal of providing 30% of local food by 2030. Here's Uchida.
Well, the only cut we're aware of is the cancellation of a grant program that is being terminated this year. So I think we have a grant that we're trying to use up all the money on. And all it means is that there won't be a grant available next year for that type of program. But the reimbursements from USDA, as far as we know, haven't been discussed or cut yet. So we're kind of monitoring the funding aspects of it.
Okay. Well, for families who are under the free and reduced lunch program, have there been any cuts to that?
No cuts yet, but we're tracking, like I said, the CEP program as well as the free and reduced meal application process, because there's rumors about having to go to 100% verification of the income. And right now, when they apply, I think we audit maybe like 3% of the applications.
So there's more red tape in order to qualify.
Yeah.
Potentially.
And they give you a 10-day window to do it, and we don't have enough staff, so we'd have to do something on the fly quickly. And so everybody, I think all the states are monitoring that right now.
And then what can you tell us about the grants that were cut? Because that was money that was available for the DOE to buy fresh produce, for example, from our farmers.
Right. We had a grant, I think we're just finishing up right now. I don't know the exact amount, but that program is being terminated across the nation. I was on a Zoom call with the USDA people, and it affected states like North Carolina, Alabama, all the way to the West Coast. So it was a nationwide program that in the chats, everybody was saying they were sad to see it go because it had created a good pipeline for the local farming community into the schools.
The other thing I have to ask is that, there was a synergy that they were trying to build on, right? You folks were looking at a centralized kitchen, potentially working, with the Wahewa Product Development Center and the Maui College one as well, just to be able to help our food security.
Right. That's still going on. I mean, no federal money is involved in that. It's a master plan for regional kitchens statewide. And so the Wahewa one is just the first one that we're looking at. We're looking at possibly two on Oahu, two on the Big Island, one on Maui, one on Kauai, and some beefed up kitchens on the neighbor islands with smaller population. But yeah, in theory, the regional kitchens would be able to get locally sourced produce and products and then mass produce them and then get them out to the schools. It's a model that regional kitchens from the mainland and Zippy's has a similar model that they do in Hawaii. So we've been touring the Zippy's facility as well as some of the mainland facilities.
Well, I know that there was money available to buy more produce and products from our local producers, mm-hmm. but we weren't able to use all that money. And so the question is, if that's still a go and that planning is still underway for that centralized kitchen, what do we do if we don't have the money to purchase the goods from our farmers?
Well, that was one of the first things I started working on when I got here in January. We took a look at the menu that we have right now. I asked the food service people to try and maximize the amount of local products in our existing menu. So they're doing that, and then we're trying to get the quantities, you know. Say they got cabbage, and we need maybe 100,000 pounds of cabbage every month. So when we set the quantity of the product we need and the quantity we need and the timing, and then we're meeting with the distributors now to make sure that they have enough farmers that can supply us with the quantity when we need it. And that's what the discussion is happening right now with the distributors. So if they don't have enough farmers, they can go out and find some more farmers. And we're working with DBED and CTAR to make sure that there's some connection between the farming community and what our needs are.
Right, because we all have to work together, whether it's a college right. or tropical, you know, agriculture or the ag department. Yeah, we need to coordinate because we are at a disadvantage since we import so much of our food.
Right.
And hopefully the lieutenant governor and her team, they can make a case for, you know, some exemption with some of these cuts.
Yes, I think that's probably on the agenda. I think we were looking at some, you know, exemptions from procurement. USDA has a very rigid procurement process. And then because we're trying to do farm to school statewide and we're an island state, we're kind of in an unusual situation from the continental U.S. So we're going to see what kind of creative solutions we can come up with to help us procure the local products faster.
And we are the only one with a single Department of Education. So
correct.
I don't know if the federal government will look at that as a plus because they just deal with one entity and then roll
yeah.
it out.
Yeah. Well, we're the only island state too. So I think there's some geographic issues that should come into play, you know.
Do you know about anything else that the Hawaii team is going to be presenting when they go to this policy summit?
No, not really. We provided some issues that we were concerned about with USDA. I haven't seen any agenda or anything, so I'm not sure what was finally decided upon.
Well, what were you folks advocating for?
Some kind of exemptions for procurement from USDA.
Okay, just yeah. less red tape.
Yeah, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I guess other states don't have to deal with, like purchasing poi, limo, tofu and stuff, right? I mean, how do we get that? Because the list that USDA, they have to approve the product type in order to get it on a procurement list. And that's kind of the challenge we have is poi is an approved product right now. So we're trying to get that approved.
Yeah, I think when we hear, you know, the school lunch program, we think of the ground beef that gets sent over and the cheese, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing under the nutrition program, right? It meets all those benchmarks.
But the 30% by 2030 is all local, got to be local produce, local products, right?
So, oh, that goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So we're trying to hit that goal. I think last year we were a little below 6%, 5 point something. And so we got 5 years to get it up to 30%, right? That's kind of what we've been focusing on right now.
Well, it is a challenge because I know even with Zippy's had said we would love to have Ulu, you know, and Mortero on the menu, but there are just not enough farmers that are producing it.
Yeah, and the game changer is DOE, you know, we're the market. We create the demand. We provide 100,000 meals a day. So if we can say this is what we need when we need it, we're sending the signal to the farming community that, you know, we're going to buy if you plant this stuff. It's not a field of dreams where if you plant cabbage, we're not going to buy it. We're going to tell you this is how much we need when we need it, right? So I think that's the game changer, is that we can control the market by ensuring that whatever they grow, we're going to buy.
Well, what is your greatest fear? If we don't get these exemptions and the money is cut, what does that mean as far as numbers of schools that may be eligible right now for free and reduced meals?
That's the CEP program, Community Eligibility Provision. It's a program in the USDA where if the school is at 60% of this poverty rate, this multiplier, then the whole school gets to eat free meals, everybody.
So right now, poor and disadvantaged families may have access to free meals if there are enough families that meet that threshold. So
right.
What's your fear there?
Well, if they increase the percentage, then some of the schools might not qualify because they're not in that low-income category anymore, right? I think, I forget what the threshold is now, but if they move it up to 60%, it'll drop a lot of schools from being able to participate.
So how many schools do we service now?
Right now we service 94 schools. And if they cut it, if they raise the threshold to 60%, that number would drop to 22.
So fewer families would have access to those meals.
Correct.
Anything else that you think would be important to underscore to our listeners just as we navigate these uncertain times about the funding?
Well, it's been like, every morning we all wake up looking at the news trying to figure out what's going to happen next, right? So it's a very stressful time right now, I think throughout the country with all the changes that are happening in D.C. But we're trying to keep our finger on the pulse, especially with USDA and how it affects our school lunch program.
Yes, and we know that lawmakers, are saying that they could come back for a special session later this fall, if need be.
Yeah, I think everybody's waiting to see what the financial impact will happen with all these cuts and things. So, jury's still out on that.
All right. Okay. Well, Dean Uchida, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Dean Uchida, Deputy Superintendent of Operations for the Department of Education. His position oversees the school food service branch. State lawmakers have been also considering a bill to have free lunch for all students and another to ensure access to nutritious meals by the growing number of needy families here in the islands.
It's a fact of urban life. Cities are just loud. Noise pollution isn't just unpleasant, it leads to health problems. Hearing damage is an obvious one, but the list is much longer than that. What some cities around the globe are doing to preserve some peace and quiet. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from HMSA. For over 85 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
I've seen some of the thought-provoking art that has been installed across the state. The Hawaii Triennial, which is often organized around a particular theme, kicked off earlier this year. And here to highlight some of the art offerings is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I've seen some of this, oh my gosh, at local parks, and Honolulu Hale. So it's really intriguing.
Yeah, and there's three artists that I highlight for this story. So they have their art installations at Capitol Modern or the Hawaii State Foundation of Culture and the Arts, the State Art Museum. And then also there's another artist that I highlighted at the main hub of the Hawaii Triennial, which is at Davies Pacific Center on the second floor. And these artists, they actually touch upon very sensitive topics such as suicide and intergenerational trauma. I've highlighted Sonia Kelleher Combs with her Idiot Strings piece, Rocky Jensen with his carved ki'i or images of Hawaiian gods, and Nancy Amaka with her multimedia piece, Cleanse Three Walls. And because they touch upon these topics of suicide, I just kind of want to give like a little bit of background of suicide that happens in Indigenous communities. So the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health shows that suicide was the second leading cause of death among Indigenous communities in the U.S., and the rates increased by 40% between 2010 and 2020. And weaving in Rocky Jensen, whose art pieces, the ki'i, that are at Capitol Modern, he died by suicide in 2023. But the curators at the Hawaii Triennial, they wanted to pay homage to him and honor him with this ki'i, but also talking about why suicide happens among Indigenous communities. I spoke with his wife, Lucia Tarallo, who spoke about his legacy leading up to his death.
Other than the one or two galleries when he first started his career,
he never showed with any of the galleries because he felt that strongly about what they were doing, and that strongly as a fact that his people had no gallery and had no place and were criticized constantly. I can't begin to tell you things that used to be said about Rocky, with those holy artists, if I'm going to use the term this time. They were merciless, prejudiced, insensitive, terrible. We went through a lot of in our lives when it came to this art form, a lot of it. Finally, I mean, because we persisted, I feel that, in a way, we went out at the end, but he didn't think so. And it took his life. He said his last words were, "My culture let me down." And he wrote it. He scrawled it on the wall.
Interesting.
Rocky Johnson, he was the master carver, and he uses art to educate his community. He was a contemporary artist, but he was also a vocal critic of art institutions that refused to buy Native Hawaiian art. He's even criticized the State Foundation of Culture and the Arts back in the day when they didn't purchase enough Native Hawaiian art. Another artist that I highlighted was Sonia Kelleher Combs, who is an indigenous artist to Alaska, and she created her piece in Idiot Strings. And I know the term idiot strings may sound a little bit different, but it's actually like these tethers used as ropes to hang the mittens in indigenous communities in Alaska. And so her piece is like this cocoon-like art installation, and from the surface it looks like they're separated, but when you see the light shining down on the strings and the cocoons, you see the shadows on this white platform, and even though those cocoons on the surface looks like they're separated, they're actually connected through the shadows. And when I talked to Sonia Kelleher Combs, she said that it was to pay homage to her three uncles who died by suicide several years ago. So she used, it's called raw sheep hide, and she, once it's dry, she wets it, and then she sews it all together, and then she uses more sheep wool to kind of tie the strings together, creating this art piece. And then she dips it in beeswax to also set it up. And so Sonia said that her work is meant for people to have an open conversation about suicide.
It's really important to be able to address and speak and not feel like you don't have an opportunity for voice with regards to suicide or mental illness, because people can die other different ways. They don't have to, you know, like suicide can be come in many different forms. So it can be a long battle. It can be a very quick one. Yeah, I think it's important to make sure that people know that every loss touches so many people. And that's why the physical manifestation of this work, that it is moving and it creates shadow. They don't actually touch these idiot strings. Idiot strings are the tethers that hold your mittens. They're floating next to each other, but they're not actually touching, but their shadows are touching. And that's a very important part, is that there's this movement and shadow and line that one loss affects many.
I also spoke with Nancy Amaka. Her piece highlights intergenerational trauma. And so she's a multimedia artist and works in different mediums. She paints. But this piece called Cleanse Three Walls, she had the idea to do that once she was pregnant with her daughter in 2017. But it's to kind of pay homage to her mother who was killed in Nigeria, which where she was born and raised before she came out into the U.S. in the 90s. When her mother passed away when she was four, she didn't find out about her death until she met with her mother's side of the family in her 20s. She didn't go into detail about how her mother was killed. She didn't want to figure out like exactly what happened. She said she still has nightmares about it, that she didn't need to pry anymore about how her mother passed away. But she created her piece in 2017 at the old Ward warehouse before it was demolished. And then she got a film crew with her, and she wanted to dedicate this space to kind of pay homage to her mother, but also to highlight the kind of mother that she wants to be like for her daughter.
The idea behind it was that I was thinking I wanted to have a video later on that I could project in any space as a sort of phantom cleaning of the space. So I could project it in, you know, my child's nursery, or I could project it in somewhere, you know, that had had a lot of like, you know, that had had a traumatic event happen in it, or I could project it as it's shown in that gallery space in the triennial, where it would sort of be me cleaning the walls of the space, metaphorically cleaning the walls of the space, because it's just a video of me washing the walls. So it's very minimal and it's very quiet in that there isn't a lot going on. It's very simple, but my wish is that when somebody goes in and experiences it, they have an excuse to think about the people that they've lost, you know, and sort of engage with those memories and, you know, take deep breath and kind of allow themselves to feel whatever they were feeling in that moment.
And so I spoke with also Noelle Kahanu, who's a co-curator, and she talks about what the theme Aloha No.
Above the O in No, instead of a kahoko, is what we would call a pewa, which is a butterfly-shaped patch often used in woodwork, so that if you see a crack in an umeke or calabash, it's often repaired with these little butterfly patches that seal the sever and keep the bowl from separating further. And they're really beautiful. I think in that sense, there's a kind of, you know, you're not trying to erase the fracture. You're acknowledging that it existed. You're beautifying it. And you're restoring the purpose to and the intention of what it was created for in order to serve and hold food or water or whatever was in that umeke.
I like that idea of not trying to erase the fracture, but acknowledging it.
Yeah. And the rest of the Hawaii Triennial will continue until like May 4th. And this is the first time that it's had its exhibitions statewide, actually. So we have exhibitions across Oahu, some on Maui, and then some on Hawaii Island, too.
All right. Well, we urge our listeners to go up, check out the art. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HVR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio, about the art featured in the triennial exhibit.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
You'll often hear the phrase wind, wave, or wing to explain how species arrived on islands in the Pacific. Here in Hawaii, it was believed ferns arrived when their spores blew in from the wind. And did you know scientists think the native land snails, the kahuli, were likely first brought to Hawaii by birds? Throughout the Pacific, these evolutionary mysteries still persist. A new study tracks down where native iguanas in Fiji and an extinct species from Tonga came from, offering clues about the ecosystems of volcanic islands. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to University of San Francisco Assistant Professor Simon Scarpetta about his new research.
I think the first thing you think when you see a big animal on an island is, how did you get here?
How did they get there, exactly? Because, yeah, Fiji and Tonga are quite isolated. And there's other animals there, of course, but having a big arboreal herbivore there is something that is like, huh, you know, that's pretty wild. So, yeah, there'd kind of been two main thoughts on how they might have gotten there before. You know, some of the first people who studied them had actually hypothesized that maybe there was a dispersal event from the Americas, because all other iguanas are found in North America, mostly, and then also Central America a lot as well, South America a bit, and then there's quite a few species in the Caribbean too. So actually, when Western scientists first saw these iguanas, I think they were confused about exactly what they were, because it seems really weird that you would have something that seemed to be so similar to the iguanas of the Western Hemisphere all the way over in Fiji. There was some disagreement about that at first. And then some of those early hypothesizing where it ended up was, well, maybe there was a dispersal event, although we're not really sure how or when that would have happened or what that would have looked like. But, you know, as you can imagine, it's such a long distance and there have been pretty few land masses in between Fiji and North America in the intervening period. And so some other scientists had another idea that, well, maybe then instead of iguanas coming from the Americas, maybe iguanas had always been in the Eastern Hemisphere ancestrally. And so maybe they came through Australia or through Southeast Asia or potentially even Antarctica or something like that, and then later on went extinct in the Eastern Hemisphere. And so those were kind of the two main ideas that there were beforehand.
And that's where phylogenomics come in, which is, I hope I'm not oversimplifying too much, but a fancy way of saying that you build evolutionary trees. And in this case, you're basing it on some genetic information. Is that how you initially saw that the North American ones and the ones in Fiji were closely related? And then what did you do from there?
Yeah. So exactly. Phylogenomics, fancy way of just saying we took a bunch of DNA sequences and then used a number of different models to try and figure out how are things related to each other. And so the other important thing that I want to add there, and what ended up being a really important part of this project, was that two of my co-authors, so a postdoc who's at Berkeley, Ben Caron, and then a professor at Villanova, Todd Jackman, had worked to develop a data set. And so they'd done some really cool pioneering work before this project to try and find basically what would be the best possible parts of the genome for solving really difficult evolutionary problems. And so we expanded on that data set for this project, and it ended up being those data that they built and that we, you know, further developed that were really, really key to figuring out with very, very good support and good certainty that Fijian iguanas and desert iguanas were each other's closest relatives.
And then ultimately, like, what all these lines of evidence lead you to conclude or suggest is that iguanas rafted from North America to the South Pacific, which is wild. That's wild. That's how it happened.
I know. It is wild.
I mean, that's just such a striking image. Talk about what that dispersal event would have looked like.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, I guess first I'll define what rafting is. So this idea that organisms can raft has been around for a while, and lots of scientists and biogeographers have thought about it. And so, you know, what is a raft? It's basically a mat of vegetation, sometimes down trees and sometimes other sort of tangled plants that are often displaced or knocked down during a hurricane or some other kind of large storm. And then they get moved from the land into the water, and then they follow along with the current of, you know, the ocean or the river or whatever it is. And then whatever animals or potentially even other plants or could be microbes or are in there can get moved from one place to the other in a way that they wouldn't have been otherwise. And so that's really what the main hypothesis is for how this would have happened. And it's worth noting that Caribbean sea rafting has actually been observed in action for iguanas, which is super cool. So in 1995, there was a group of scientists who actually observed one of these floating vegetation rafts going through the Caribbean. I think it was from some of the islands around Guadeloupe, and then it ended up on the island of Anguilla. It moved some 300 kilometers, and rafting on it were a bunch of green iguanas. And so they actually, you know, saw them going from one place to the other, and they ended up on an island that they didn't used to be on before, which is wild. And so that's our hypothesis, and that's what we supported for this study too. I should also mention that it turns out that of all the living species of iguanas, like well over half of them are found on islands. There's definitely something that appears to predispose them not only to be able to raft, but then also to be successful at rafting too, to be able to establish on arrival and to be able to even survive the journey. And so, you know, they're pretty big. They're herbivorous, all the species are. So they may have even had a source of food on their rafting. Most of the species, or many of the species, are resistant to heat. They're resistant to starvation. They're resistant to dehydration. And so really, if you had to pick any particular group of lizard or any animal that could really make a journey like that and actually happen, you know, iguanas, they'd be the one.
Thinking about another volcanic island, which is the island of Oahu and more largely the Hawaiian Islands, what can a study like this tell us about volcanic islands and the evolution and dispersal of species on them?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a lot of people have and, you know, will continue to hypothesize and show that dispersal over water is the preferred mechanism for how plants and animals get to volcanic islands. Because they shoot up so quickly, they can be ephemeral, it's very unlikely for most of them that they were ever connected to any kind of, you know, continental mainland. And so I think this study definitely, you know, one, it kind of shows the scope of, all right, how far can things go over water if they're not flying or they're not being carried as a vector on something that flies? And I think it really just supports that line of evidence, that line of reasoning that's, I think, already pretty strongly supported, that that is how things get to volcanic islands. And if you're really, really far out in the middle of the ocean, there's kind of only one way to get there, and it's across water.
You mentioned that you were a National Science Foundation postdoc. Maybe talk a little bit about what that funding meant to you and any perspective you have on some of the current uncertainty when it comes to funding, particularly for early career scientists.
Yeah, the first answer is that it meant everything. And I have a lot of friends right now whose funding is being, you know, affected or cut off. Yeah, family whose NIH funding is being cut off too. I really wouldn't have been able to do this work unless it was for my funding from NSF. It's a really, really rigorous process to get that funding, and it does not come lightly. And so it was, you know, a huge honor for me to get it in the first place. And yeah, I wouldn't have been able to do this cool research without it, because to be able to buy food and rent and stuff. But then the research funding enabled to be able to do the sequencing and get all of the tissue samples and do everything else in the lab. It meant everything. And so can't underemphasize how important funding from NSF and NIH and all of these federal agencies, USGS, really is for making science happen.
That was evolutionary biologist Simon Scarpetta, who spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. His research into Fijian iguanas was published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. We'll have a link to it on our website after the show.
On this week's On the Media, a recent executive order cut funds for the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which, among other things, oversees Voice of America.
VOA stood for a defense of democracy and free press across the world. And this is an administration that does not stand for those things.
The demise of soft power on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Finding forever homes for animals in any community is tough enough, but add to that a disaster, and it can be doubly hard. Today, we hear more about a program that started on the Valley Isle and is being used as a model across the country. Here to talk about that is HVR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so tell us about this new model and how we're using it.
Yeah, so this is through the Maui Humane Society. It's called the Dogs on Demand or Beach Buddies Program. There's a couple of variations of it. It's actually not new. It's been going on for about 10 years, but it's gained, as you mentioned, national attention and success. The Maui Humane Society takes in nearly 5,000 animals annually, and there's often about 100 dogs in the shelter program. Some of them are in foster care. Not all of them are at the shelter at any given time. But the Dogs on Demand program allows those dogs a chance to get out of the kennel environment, where often they experience a lot of stress. You know, kennels are a tough place for animals to be. They have emotional stress. It's really loud. And even with the best care from shelter staff and volunteers, you know, it is not an ideal situation for them. And so getting these dogs out of the shelter for even just an afternoon makes a huge difference for them. You know, these outings allow people, both visitors as well as locals, to take a dog out on a buddy program. They can take them to a dog-friendly restaurant. They can take them out to the beach, though not, they explain not all dogs actually like the beach, the waves, but you can take them out, you know, to your home and enjoy an afternoon in the air conditioning where they can, you know, just take a nap and really decompress. There's a lot of different options. It's really what you want to do with the dog. Volunteers said that, you know, they often just come and grab a dog if they're going for a drive or, you know, taking a walk. It's really popular with visitors. It's become like an attraction. It's booked months in advance. And so people coming to Maui, you know, maybe they miss their dogs at home. Maybe they, you know, just want to do something, volunteer in the community while they're here, and they can grab a dog and head on out for the afternoon. You know, there's health issues involved too for the dogs. You know, one dog named Starburst has a condition called Happy Tail, in which, you know, she's wagging her tail and it's constantly hitting against the side of the cement kennel. And so she actually, you know, the end of her tail has become raw. And so outings like this just give them an opportunity to step out and really shine in a way that they're not able to in the kennels. You know, volunteers and staff notice that they're much more relaxed. They're able to interact with people in a way that they're not able to in the kennels. So the program started about 10 years ago with a dog named Dwight, who was experiencing some of these challenges in the kennel. And it was really successful. And so it just grew from this one dog really thriving when he went on these outings. And, you know, staff have shared with me, you know, they've been doing this on Maui, not realizing that it's anything novel or realizing its impact until other shelters across the country started reaching out, and it began really gaining traction. And now Maui Humane Society staff have gone all over the country to do workshops. They just got back from Arizona, sharing it with a shelter there. Lexi Hughes is enrichment manager at Maui Humane Society, and she shares about the work they've done to share the program.
We've partnered up with the Banfield Foundation, and Kim Van Syke, who's executive director of the Banfield Foundation, helped make this project and sharing this with other organizations and other shelters happen. She actually participated in our program. Just, you know, she was here on vacation, and a dog similar to Dwight, his name was Jake, where he just was not showing well in the kennel because he was jumping up and having a hard time settling. And then outside of the kennel, he was connecting, loving. She saw the potential of this program and its life-saving capacity, and so she's really the one that helped us be able to reach out to other shelters. I think right now we're, with this last seminar we just did, in conjunction with a few other really talented, amazing instructors, I think we've done about 40 shelters now, and most of them do have their dog outing programs launched. And so the effect that it has is now in the thousands of dogs that it is benefiting. Some of the really heartwarming ones are the shelters that they're at capacity as well. And then there's also like 100 dogs out the door. So the dog on demand program for them is life-saving. It is literally connecting that dog with someone in the community to be their advocate and helping them make sure they have a positive outcome. They're going to foster, they're getting adopted. And so that is like really meaningful to us, that we get to help save animals we don't even know. Mm-hmm. The impact is, it's wild to think about it, of how far it's spreading.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see, how this field trip with the pet is helping these animals.
Yeah, and absolutely. One of the issues you mentioned earlier, too, was about housing. We've heard a lot about housing affecting people on Maui, but it's also affecting pets. And so that lack of housing for pet-friendly is leading to a lot of surrenders. Victoria Yvonne Kitch is of the Humane Society. She talked about the impact that that's having and the ways that the Humane Society is trying to help.
The pet housing crisis that we're seeing, it was happening before the fires. I mean, housing in general is very difficult on an island that only has so much space. But after the fires, there's a whole piece of land that is no longer available for people to live in. So what we're seeing now is people who have lost their home or going from rental to rental, and a lot of rentals don't allow pet-friendly or pet-inclusive housing. And I always like determining the difference there. Pet-friendly sounds nice, and oftentimes it is cats or dogs under 30 pounds. Okay, how many dogs under 30 pounds do you know here on Maui? Most of the dogs that we care for and the ones that get kind of caught up in our system are bigger. So, you know, places will say, oh, we're pet friendly, and then it's super limiting by breed and size, and it's just not ideal. So some of the things we're doing, I mean, we do everything we can for the animals, but we can't create housing at this point. So we're offering to landlords, hey, if we can help supplement something for your insurance company to allow bigger dogs, or for renters, if we can help with a pet deposit or containment for the animal, you know, what can we do to make sure the pets can stay in homes? I want to say it accounts for about 25% of our surrenders is due to housing. So again, we try everything we can, but that's the one thing that we can't argue. You know, if somebody can't afford veterinary care, we can help with that. If they need food, we can help with that. Training, yes, but housing, that's just out of our hands.
And we understand that the other intake shelter on Maui has closed its doors?
It has. So that's put an extra strain on the Maui Humane Society. But, you know, they have some really positive programs going on and doing the best they can to help folks and animals.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is traveling to Hawaii this week, kicking off a trip to Guam, the Philippines, and Japan. He's set to meet with military and civilian leaders from the Indo-Pacific Command to take part in a ceremony to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima. Hegseth caught flak during his confirmation hearing for past comments he made stating that women should not serve in combat roles. He said during his hearing that he supports women in the military. As we mark Women's History Month, we're honohoing an interview from last year with Chief Warrant Officer Asia White. It was this month, 31 years ago, that the U.S. Navy assigned the first women to combatant ships, changing naval policy forever. When we spoke with her, the South Carolina native was assigned to the USS Shiloh, a missile cruiser. White is married with two children, and her spouse, Melodina, is also in the Navy and was stationed in Japan. We sat down with White in the mess hall one afternoon to talk about her life in the Navy today as a woman of color. She's still very much a minority in the new Navy.
I think it's absolutely amazing that they allowed us to get on board, you know, 30 years ago. And even since then, we've had so many firsts. I remember when they allowed us to be on the first submarine. Every day, we're making a way.
And so how many women are on this ship?
So on this ship now, let's say we have approximately 5 female officers, because we have one coming inbound, and one chief petty officer. She's actually a senior chief. And maybe about 50 junior sailors, which isn't a lot when you compare it to how many males we have on board.
And so did you have a mentor, you know, somebody in your family, a relative who, you know, was in the military, who could kind of share their experience?
So I actually had an uncle who was in the Army, and he used to tell me, you know, the stories back from when he was in war and the significance of seeing the ranks and what they meant to him. Since then, I have two main mentors, both of them females. Both of them I met when I was a junior sailor myself on my first ship, USS Iwo Jima. And that is now Master Chief Petty Officer Virginia Sanders and retired Chief Petty Officer Carmen Sharper. It's crazy, when I made Chief Petty Officer, they came to put my anchors on me. And when I was selected for commission and got to do my commissioning ceremony, they came to remove my anchors in my cover. So they've became family over the years.
So you have children. I guess when you think of the opportunities that you have, what do you hope for them?
I hope they can, one, enjoy the world. They get to see the world. And in its purest form, right? Sometimes there's ethnic things about being in the military. And I get it. We're not a perfect organization, but we strive each and every day. And so if I can make the world better for them, every day I'll continue to make this sacrifice. So I simply just want them to enjoy the world.
I know a Navy commander who just feels like she's had a tough go because this is a male-dominated service, and it's rough sometimes. When you think back in your career, have you think of some low points?
I actually had an amazing time in the military. I was graceful enough to be placed in the perfect places with the perfect people who just wanted to see me succeed. So the closest thing I got to a low point, I would say, would be when the George Floyd situation happened. I think it really shook not only the civilian world, but the military as a whole. Because the same way women are a minority, if you look at the race, it's a different as well. So that was the closest thing I was to a low point. But still, at that time, my captain, amazing individual, Captain Schultz, he allowed us to communicate. And not just that, we did something at the command and he shared that with his other captains. So they did something for the base to allow other people to share stories and have their voices heard. But I've had a pretty blessed career.
And then where do you want to go with, you know, your experience so far?
Overseas. Does not matter. Just send me overseas. Stateside is nice, but the opportunity to see different cultures, to be a part of their world, is something you don't always get. So why not take the advantage of it?
Have you talked to folks who have been, let's say, in combat? It's pretty tough times.
Yes. We have people on board the ship now who've served in Afghanistan and been on boots on ground, and it's different. Hearing their stories, hearing the way they had to sleep in tents and stuff like that while everything is still going around them, it's a different life.
So you feel pretty fortunate to be comfortable right now on this ship here in Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor is nice. But at the same time, you know, we have to understand. So there's different phases of ships. Right now we're a sustainment ship. So if at any case, anything happens around the world and we need to be activated, we stay manned and ready. So comfort can only go so far because we have to stay in the military mindset, being ready to serve.
And then I have covered many stories over the years, you know, where you see families that have been separated and when they come back again, I mean, that's always a joy, you know, whether it's a parent seeing his child for the first time or just the fact that you've been separated and then you come together as a family unit. I mean, what's that like for you?
It's always a good time to see my children. It can be rough, especially for a long time in the military. I was a single parent. Even right now, I'm married and, you know, my spouse is still serving in Yokosuka, Japan. We make sacrifices. You know, we may not always make it to every birthday. We may not always make it to every graduation, but we commit to serving. So yes, you know, the anniversary and being there and sharing those life events, we cherish time.
So I'm trying to wrap my head around this. Okay, so your spouse is in another place. Oh, so where are the kids?
So my son is here. My son is here. My daughter is right now in Chicago. So she comes during the summer and every major holiday. So it's a lifestyle. But my son plays baseball. He enjoys it. He played it in Yokosuka as well. My daughter plays soccer, and it's a life they've grown up be accustomed to at this point. I've been there for 16 years.
So how old are they?
My son is 17 and my daughter is 12. Yeah, he's graduating this year and joining the military himself.
What branch?
Navy. Always Navy.
You know, I don't know how you folks do it. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I came from a military family, and I mean, but I just think, man, it can be really difficult.
It is, but the Navy's greatest asset is its people. So we build communities and bonds around us all the time. So like, my best friend is here now, helping me out whenever I got to go underway. When I was in Yokosuka, same thing. The friends and the family you meet, they become your family. It's, you know, you learn blood is only a thing, you know. However, life is what you make it. So we get in the mindset, we understand why we serve, and we do what we need to do.
Why is it so important that we keep talking about this, where women are in the military these days?
Because we didn't always have that opportunity. You know, I had a conversation or a panel with Foreign Navy that's just now starting to integrate females. And they wanted to know how we get to where we are now. And so it's just like, hey, understanding that they're continuing to allow us, and one day we'll no longer have these firsts and we'll be equals across the board, across the world. So if we cherish and keep making these milestones important now, everyone will recognize it.
Is there anything you want to say just about equity?
In the military, I could say myself, I haven't had any experience with not being treated respectfully or anything else. Is that everyone's story? Probably not. Because if we did have everyone being treated equal, then we wouldn't continue to have to share or have these instances where we have training on just how to treat people. They just came up with a new policy pertaining to females in the military, not just any female, but females who get pregnant in the military. They extended the time where they're allowed to spend with their children, their newborns, for that integration, you know, type of status, and, you know, and not just that, they are allowing them to stay within their ratings, which allows them to still be competitive. Before this recent policy change, they'd get sent to some command, you know, not a lot of choice in it, working out a rate. And when it comes to them advancing in the military, that can be looked at kind of in a negative light. So to me, just that policy change alone, allowing them to still be an asset in their community, that's another step forward of recognizing what we do in the military and how important we are as women. I think one of the biggest things to always acknowledge is the point that the Navy's not perfect, the military's not perfect, but the will to work together to get it right each and every day is what matters the most. They have this saying as chief petty officers that you have to earn that anchor each and every day, which means you have to work to be great every day, not for you, but for your sailors, those to come as the one, as well as the ones you've had in the past. And to me, as a female in the military, my job is to make it easier for those to come after me, as well as those who's already serving, to be that mentor, to help mold them, to help them be successful as well. My actual commissioning ceremony was composed of all females for the sole reason that we don't always get recognized. And we're so few that it was an event that a lot of people say they've never seen before. And it was not anything negative against the males, loved them to death. It was just to share the moment and recognize women in the military.
And be proud of it.
Very proud of it. So that's it. I think it's important for us all to, one, recognize that yes, we are still the minority, but still be in the mindset of understanding that we're here to stay, we're here to succeed, we're here to strive to be great.
That was Chief Warrant Officer Asia White talking about what it's like to be in the Navy as they recently marked the anniversary of a policy change that allowed women to serve on combat ships. White serves as an information warfare officer and has served in the military for 17 years. She's still stationed here at Pearl Harbor. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about security in the Indo-Pacific region from a respected expert from Japan. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.